My interest in the problem of rectal fibroplasia started during my residency at the D.C. General Hospital in Washington. And it seemed that the number of cases that we were observing with a very severe disease, virtually total blindness, were occurring in babies. When we looked at the nursing records, showed that there had been an oxygen for long periods. No one was measuring the concentration of oxygen at that time. In fact, as there were no orders for oxygen, and the only way we could determine that they even received it is in the nursing notes, occasionally there would be an entry saying that the baby is in continuous oxygen. But there seemed to be enough of a direction toward the severe cases to those that had been in longer periods of oxygen that we looked more carefully at the possibility that this could be a quote, contributing factor, and set up to do a controlled study looking at the oxygen management on a scientific basis. First, we applied to NIH for a small grant, a $4,000 grant total. That was to conduct the study and also to set up a laboratory and conduct animal studies with small animals in the incubator as the babies. The application went in, and it got a very interesting review. Namely, it was quickly reviewed in contrast to the normal months of deliberations. And the review was very simple. It stated that there's nothing scientific whatsoever about the possibility that oxygen, what these babies breathe with every breath, could possibly be so damaging to the eye to destroy the retina and blind these babies. And since it's totally unscientific that oxygen could do that, there's no place for this study, and indeed it's totally unethical to restrict oxygen for any reason where there's no better documentation of why than what these investigators are proposing, namely that the babies seem to have had more oxygen than those that didn't have the longer periods. And the final conclusion was grant. Not only was it turned down, it was given a very low priority, and then they struck through the low priority and said totally declined, so it didn't get a priority at all. Well, I was young enough then and obviously not smart enough to know that that was an unfavorable review. So we went to the chairman of pediatrics, who felt that the study that we had proposed really gave no risk to the babies because every child would receive oxygen wherever there's clinical need. And indeed, the one group they restricted oxygen was simply oxygen for clinical need. That clinical need could end up with them getting more oxygen than the so-called liberal oxygen. The liberal oxygen was a standard of care which was then used, which was simply put the baby in oxygen, a small preemie, for 30 days if the birth weight was below 3 pounds, and then gradually taper off and remove them because they would have become acclimatized to the oxygen at that period. So the new concept in terms of the study that we wanted to evaluate was reducing that automatically high oxygen that was in the standard care to a more restricted plan to give it to the baby on clinical need, but liberally for any need. I mean, if someone walked down the corridor and said, you know, I think that baby might need a little oxygen, boom, they went right in for therapy in the incubator. Or if they were getting a little oxygen, it was raised. And anything you can dream of that might suggest to someone, well, maybe that baby needs oxygen, they would automatically get it. So the clinical need was a very liberal terminology, but it at least separated them. And as it turns out, no one had ever bothered to measure the oxygen in the incubator. We measured it every 8 hours. That was required in both groups. So one could see that the liberal oxygen, the standard of care, turned out to be 4 to 5-fold greater oxygen exposure than what the clinical need group received. Well, 5 months into that study, Kate Campbell from Australia reported in the Medical Journal of Australia a phenomenal study, at least in our opinion, namely in the three hospitals where she had examined the babies and had them examined, that in the one city hospital where oxygen was given liberally and there was no charge for the oxygen because of it being a city hospital, they had a very significantly higher rate of retroventral fibroplasia in that period. And the second hospital where the oxygen was given on a little less liberal grounds, but no rigid restriction, that it was an intermediate amount of the disease. But this one small private hospital where each baby was charged per tank of oxygen. For some reason in Melbourne, oxygen was expensive, and so that the patient was billed but per tank, that the oxygen was not so routinely given in high amounts. And that being the only difference in that small hospital and the other two, and they had a significantly greater reduction in the disease, namely less retroventral fibroplasia at that time compared to the two other hospitals. Now, the pediatric community worldwide, particularly in the U.S., thought that her study was purely pie in the sky. This didn't make sense to look at data that were so poorly managed as far as scientific observations. And they just couldn't believe it, that cost of oxygen, which actually the economic aspect of it is what determined the lesser amount given in that hospital, could be possibly a factor. She raised it as a question. And we were 6 months into our study. We thought it was a wonderful study, and it just fitted exactly what we were thinking. And we were beginning to see some trend already in our small nursery study. But we went on and carried on the study for a full year, and at the end of that period, there was a striking difference, particularly in the severe RLF. There were no cases of advanced RLF in those babies in our study that were in the standard of care, oxygen for clinical need, as compared to the standard of care, where there was approximately 1/4 of those babies had advanced disease. Now, there were mild cases of RLF in both groups, and they were almost equal, but slightly more in the liberal use. Pause. Now, there were other observations in two main hospital centers where the amount of oxygen given seemed to be related to the incidence of the disease of RLF. And one of those was in the nursery program in Dr. Cross in Great Britain. And her work was published actually in 1952, which is early on as far as the clinical observations. And the next move, though, was that of Dr. Everett Kinsey, who had worked originally with Dr. Terry, who identified RLF with premature birth. And having worked in Dr. Terry's laboratory, because Dr. Terry had some ideas about possible causes, a long list of them. And in fact, as it was so long, I think he might have said lack of oxygen, too much oxygen, and he went on. But no one paid any attention to the oxygen comment that he had made. But Every Kinsey saw this as a first controlled clinical trial, namely our study, and felt that it should be confirmed rapidly or tossed out. And I thoroughly agreed with him. And at any rate, he organized 18 hospitals to test the oxygen concept. And there was a program to plan this, and Dr. Jonas Friedenwald from Wilmer, who had actually been one of the pioneers to describe the early pathology of the disease in the babies, with Dr. Owens and Owens from Wilmer also. And in that regard, I want to be sure to give Owens and Owens credit, because they were the first to demonstrate, actually in the late 1940s, that the RLF actually had nothing to do with a prenatal intrauterine problem, that these babies were born, in so far as their eye findings, essentially normal. And the disease developed postnatally during the nursery stay. He was criticized by Dr. Virchow of Boston, who was a very prominent research and clinical ophthalmologist. And Virchow, at one of the Wilmer meetings, commented on Bill Owens' beautiful study, that's very interesting what you just presented, but you're not talking about the right disease. We're talking about RLF, as Dr. Terry described it, and that started in utero. And Dr. Owens said that's only because he didn't know what he was looking at, because he had no way to know what was happening in utero. And they had an interesting dialogue. Well, as it turns out, Bill Owens was absolutely right, because going into the nursery shortly after birth, he started looking at the babies. And they all looked the same, namely essentially normal. And they started developing the disease, visible changes within a week, 2 weeks, 3 weeks after birth. So that was a major step forward. But in terms of the disease and moving into Everett Kinsey, Owen's work put a shift in emphasis on anything that might be a so-called prenatal cause, and it had to be, or at least according to his findings, which turned out to be true, postnatal, namely something that's happening to those babies in the nursery. Now, Everett Kinsey recognized in our study that for the first time there was an element of controlled clinical trial. And I recognized immediately in this meeting with Dr. Friedenwald chairing it, to have these 18 hospitals, we met in Bethesda, by the way, to see if there was a reason to go ahead and all these other hospitals, many doing studies of their own, to give those up and do a collaborative clinical trial that Everett Kinsey would chair. And I mentioned at that meeting that I could not be in that study, having just done this original study, but I'd be happy and honored to serve with Everett, because I thought he was 100% right. And I served on the consulting committee to the study. It was not an advisory committee. It didn't have the sophisticated names of the modern clinical trials. But Dr. Richard Day from Columbia, who worked on the disease, and I worked with Everett Kinsey. Kinsey, being a PhD, wanted a physician and physicians and his advisory panel. Well, there were several of the investigators, though, said, wait a minute, that clinical trial that Patz's group did looks good enough for me. Let's just put all the babies in oxygen for clinical need only and follow them. And if that study is correct, it should show within a period of time. And one of the most illustrious pediatricians, a Dr. Harry Gordon, cut. Do you want this much detail? That planning session where Dr. Jonas Friedenwald chaired the 18 hospital group of investigators. Dr. Harry Gordon would come to Hopkins to head up the premature nursery here. Had an interest in oxygen and was very aware of our study. In fact, as I'd shown him the data, because he moved from Colorado to Baltimore, and he was one of the world-renowned authorities on premature care, and reviewed with him the data, and he was so impressed with the study, he said, well, you know, you've got to correct Everett Kinsey, because let's just put all those people together and test this study in a simple way, namely, put all the babies in and see if it turns out. Well, I thought Kinsey was correct, because the possibility that you couldn't prove it that way, that you're dealing with a medication that is life-saving and where there's a clinical need. And the worst thing would be to have poor data and have that element of, quote, restriction of oxygen by the pediatrician entering into the decision-making of how to take care of that baby. And the point is that we hadn't proven in any way whatsoever that we hadn't caused an increase in the death rate. But we didn't actually keep data that was meaningful in that regard. So I argued in that group that it should be randomized, but it should be a protective randomization. Namely, 1 in 10 babies would go into the, quote, high oxygen, and the 9 out of 10. And Everett Kinsey had showed me that he could do a clear study that way and get those 10% that are going into the high oxygen in early, so that you could have the benefit of, say, every third baby going into the high oxygen. And that's how the study was done. Well, then, within three months, the study showed overwhelmingly that the restricted oxygen was indeed a very positively documented. Plus, we were able to produce in experimental animals the counterpart of the early disease, just putting them in little incubators, mice. At that point, Professor Norman Ashton in London, brilliant experimental eye pathologist, had produced the disease, early disease, in kittens placed in oxygen. So here you had the experimental findings following the clinical, but backing up the clinical in terms of its significance. And that was a very gratifying thing to all the people who had to deal with the disease, because RLF had become, within 8 or 9 years from the time that Terry first identified it with prematurity, not only the leading cause of blindness in children in this country, but greater than all other causes of child blindness combined. And Everett Kinsey and I were recognized for that clinical work, and me for my clinical and the experimental, with the Lasker Award, which introduced me to Helen Keller, which is one of the true highlights of my entire lifetime, not only my academic career. And at that program of the Lion, at the ceremony of the Lasker Foundation to present the awards, Helen Keller was a special guest and presented the award to Dr. Kinsey and to me. And she was with her companion, who was the second miracle worker following Sullivan, and this was Polly Thompson. And it was fascinating to see how Polly and Miss Keller communicated, because Polly Thompson kept her left palm right beside her Helen Keller's left elbow, and so Helen Keller could just, with a fingertip, write in the palm. And that was about 5 sentences. And it was amazing, they had a form of shorthand and communicated. And the first communication, I was puzzled, because when they were announcing my name to get the award, Helen Keller starts talking to Polly Thompson, because they'd asked her to take the award, and she pulled it over closer to her. And in her phenomenal tactile sense appreciation, this non-elevated labeling of the award, she immediately said, "This is not Dr. Patz's statue." And Polly Thompson said, "Oh, well, I'll get it corrected." So Helen Keller said, no, forget it. And she said, "He'll never know the difference." So what she did, having scanned the thing with her palms, she put my hand over where the name is, and the award actually, the medal was to the Jonas Salk statue. And so she pulled my hand over and held it right there. And the only thing is, when the New York Times photographer was there to take the pictures, he then took her hand away from mine, took both of them, and put them up top of the statue, as you see there in the photograph, whereupon I had my hand free, and it wasn't comfortable, so I just moved over a little bit. So it ends up, I'm covering half of Jonas Salk's name and not the other. But she was right. I didn't know the difference. Helen Keller, I want to just tell you, in the wonderful session afterwards where we were at an informal reception and then lunch, Helen Keller wanted to know more about this disease and how did we get interested in it. And it wasn't like she'd been primed. Depending on what answer I gave, is what her next question would be. And she was just so intelligent and articulate. And she said, "Well, now, a lot of these babies are totally blind." And I said, "Yes." She said, "But are all of them totally blind?" I said, "No, many of them have partial vision." And she said, "Oh, that's wonderful." And talking through Polly Thompson, she said, "But what you want to be sure is those that have that partial vision, that they get to facilities where whatever's," and this is 1956, "where the ability to help them with devices," and she said magnifiers, but she said, "I don't know what I'm talking about," but she said magnifiers. And she said, "And then secondly, the children are totally blind. They should have a lot of counseling toward reassurance, particularly if they have their hearing. They have their hearing, and obviously they have their voice." And what she was saying is that in her case, her problem was the fact that she couldn't hear as well as not have the sight. So if they have that, she said they should be taught that the blindness really is not a disability. It's almost like an inconvenience. And here's this woman coming on there so positively. And it was very inspiring. And then she talked about the Lions Club. She said, "You know, I've had a wonderful relationship with the International Lions, and they are committed to the visually handicapped. And I charged them," and then she paused for a second, said, "in 1925 to become Knights, K-N-I-G-H-T-S, Knights for the Blind." And she said, "From what I've been told, they are living up to that charge and doing a marvelous job." So I think in terms of our Lions Low Vision Center here, I think Helen Keller would be very proud to see what's been accomplished in this program, as well as what's been achieved internationally in that. But she, just as she was leaving, she said, "You know, I can't waste all of your time to tell you some things that happened to me while I was working to rehabilitate the blind soldiers and naval officers from Great Britain who were killed, who were blinded from the wartime injury, many civilians during the bombing of London." And she said, "Here, these were soldiers in the 20s, 30s, totally blind. And she said, I just couldn't spend enough time with them. And she made a date to go back. She made four trips. She made arrangements to go back the next time about 3 months later. And Miss Thompson told her that she'd received an invitation to visit Sir Winston Churchill when she came back on the next trip. And she just said, just tell him I'll be too busy with these plans. And I'm sorry. Well, apparently Polly Thompson got it across to her that this was something that was special. But she said, well, I don't want anything special. I want to spend every minute I have with those soldiers. Well, finally they got through her head. It was appropriate. She met with him at 10 Downing Street. But Polly Thompson chuckled when she told the story. But Helen Keller said, you know, I don't regret that I went. He was so charming and hospitable. Okay. With the incrimination of oxygen as the primary cause of RLF, there was a rapid decline worldwide in the disease. And indeed, there was a period of several years when there was really a low incidence almost globally. But then we move into the mid-70s, and actually starting even in the early 70s, and the pediatric care has been so improved that many of these very small preemies, the ones weighing, for example, 2 pounds at birth, they were living instead of having a very low survival rate. For example, in the 1950s, a 2-pound baby had less than a 10% chance of survival. So they didn't live to develop the disease. Whereas here, 20 years later, we're seeing improved pediatric care, saving the smaller babies who, by virtue of their more premature birth, have a more immature retina and are more prone to develop the disease. And we begin to see a recurrence, not of the epidemic proportions, in that period. And as we move into the 1980s, continued increase in survival of these very small high-risk babies. So by the late 80s, we're seeing a new set of cases that are coming from these extremely low birth weight infants. And by the 90s, the disease was almost as prevalent as far as number of cases as during the period of the 1950s, when it was very significant insofar as the incidence. There have been several studies done, though, to see just what can be done in these small babies, and it doesn't seem to be a clear-cut way and direction to go. But there are new findings suggesting that there are changes related to blood vessel proliferation that are common in the RLF. And by the way, by this time, the disease has been changed in its terminology from retrorenal fibroplasia to retinopathy of prematurity. And this is a more appropriate name because it covers all stages of the disease. The fibroplasia part really implied primarily to the more advanced permanent or cicatricial stages of the condition. So sticking now with the term of ROP, the whole plan is to see with the increased cases if there are treatment modalities available. Pause. The treatment methods for retinal blood vessel proliferation, for example, as occurs in diabetic retinopathy, had been demonstrated with the laser type of photocoagulation. And cryotherapy also was a tool that provided a way to close those vessels and to reduce the proliferation in the active stages. And a controlled clinical trial, multicenter, for cryotherapy showed it to be clearly beneficial. And subsequent control studies using laser treatment were proved to be beneficial. So there were methods to treat and control, partially control, the progression of the disease in the cases that were occurring in the late 1970s, 80s, and 90s. And there are suggestions that some of the methods of controlling VEGF, vascular endothelial cell growth factor, might be applicable to this condition. And in the animal model, it does relate, and inhibitors of VEGF appear in the animal model to suppress the VEGF in the animal subject. So these areas of new treatment are really the background for an international symposium. It'll be held this November in conjunction with the American Academy of Ophthalmology. It'll start the day before and be an all-day symposium. Cut. And both of you